Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 152. I'm recording this on my little mobile kit because I'm away filming at the moment. Hope the quality is okay. Yeah, how you all doing, guys? Did I say 152? It's 153. I can't remember what I said. It's 153 if I said two. If I said three, then ignore this section. Man, this is a good podcast this week. Genuinely one of my favourites I've ever done. And those who listen every week will know that's not something I just say every week. But yeah, a great episode with the wonderful Sophia Batella. I recorded this while I was in LA a few weeks ago, which is also where I recorded last week's episode, the spoken word one, which got an amazing reaction. So thank you all very much for the reaction to that. That meant the world. I didn't expect that to go out as early as it did. Basically, I recorded that because I know that at the moment I'm away filming and I've got a load of other things on at the moment, so I don't want to miss a podcast. So I recorded that as an emergency, and I thought last week was going to be the special on Destiny that I went to LA to do. Yeah, I'm doing a special with Activision on Destiny 2. It's fascinating. I got crazy, unprecedented access to some of the creators and some of the gamers. Had an amazing time out there. Also, before I went, I spoke to Dan Lassac because he's big into that game, so I'm excited about that special. But I was thinking, oh, I'll have to rush that out. It was going to be hard because it's a load of different conversations, but they kind of kindly said, no, there's no rush. Like, let's put it out in July kind of time. So so that was cool, but it then meant I didn't want to put this week's one out last week because Sophia's new film, The Mummy, is out next week. So I wanted to put that out now. So I didn't want to put it out. Anyway, there was a spoken word one last week and I got a lot of love and loads of kind words. Thank you very much for that. Also need to mention, this is the first intro I think I've recorded since we launched the Dark Summer range. So me and my label, Speech of Element Records, have released swimwear. We've released swim shorts, swimsuits, leggings. There's snapbacks and all sorts of vests and all sorts. But the biggest seller has been the sunglasses that are just these really nice matte black sunglasses with our slogan of we may not be for you and that's fine. On the arms, and they've been flying out. Obviously, I'm not really a hard sell guy, so if you're not after any swimwear, then don't go and get any. But it's free to have a look, and the photo shoot we did is one of my favourite projects I've done, right? So me, amazing photographer Shaylione Wolf, and his assistant Asha, we also took along Chris Glasson of Hardcore Listing and Redshift Rebels fame, a Megan Biffin to do the makeup, a Vicky Kate or Tawny Photo on Instagram to do the behind the scenes, and we broke into an abandoned pontins, and we did this amazing shoot in the abandoned swimming pool, in the abandoned snooker hall, outside the abandoned pub, just everywhere. It's mad. The images that we got are stunning. So go to scroobiuspip.co.uk and there's a gallery there, but equally I've got it on my Facebook page and on my Instagram. And please, the models I got, I was blown away by. They were absolutely amazing. So please follow them. If you go to my Instagram, is the best for that. If you go to my Instagram to look at the photos, I will have tagged them in every photo. But it was Jess Megan, Chili Ray, Teta Maria, Giacomo Marone, Giacomo Giacomo. I kept calling him Giacomo. It's pronounced Giacomo. I'm an idiot. Marone and Tommy Wills. And yeah, mate, just check those photos out and go and give those kids some love and some follows. I mean, I've also got a lot of love for my explosive fitness instigated abs. So thanks for that too. That's very kind of you all. A lot of people said, have you just released swimwear because you've got abs at the moment? And it's quite the opposite. I got abs because I knew I was releasing swimwear. I was like, I need to model this. I need to get in shape. So, yeah. So that was fun. So go and check that out. As said, Instagram or Twitter or wherever, at ScroobiusPipYo, Facebook.com/ScroobiusPip, blah, 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 blah. Check all that out. Onto this podcast, though. I've said a few times, it's always a worry when it's someone that you've not really met that... Like, I've not met... I met Sophia before now. This was a beautiful one, actually, because I'd actually been approached by Universal to talk to her when she's in London. And I'm away filming and I'm busy. But we follow each other on Twitter. So I kind of just hit her up while I was in LA and said, do you fancy a chat? And I was amazed that she made time, considering she's one of three leads. It's her, Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe are the leads in The Mummy. And that comes out, that's out next week. But this was only recorded a couple of weeks ago. So it was in full promo mode. And she's also in a film called Atomic Blonde coming out, which I saw the trailer in the cinema out there and it looks amazing. So I was buzzing for that. So yeah, we hooked it up and we sat down and had a chat and it was amazing. Yeah, as I was saying, it's kind of, there's sometimes that nerves that if you've not met someone, if the conversation will be flowing, if they're going to be a good talker. I mean, particularly even, you know, someone who English isn't their first language, it's like how's this going to go? And I was just in absolute awe for most of this podcast because the stories that she told, the routes we went down, her general outlook and attitude was just so inspirational to me. So, yeah, it couldn't have gone better. I couldn't have been happier with that conversation. So I went back to my little Airbnb and converted it all, just delighted serendipitous nature of my trip timing with when she was in LA before she goes off to Australia and Japan, I think, to promote it and all this kind of thing. So yeah, it's a great episode. You're going to love it. I want to talk at this point about some of the stories and some of her history, but I'll let her do it. Hey, let's let her cover that. I'll be back at the end to mention a few things. Hardcore Listing. If you're a fan of the Hardcore Listing podcast with Chris and Stu, who are my two idiot friends on the Drunk Casts, then their podcast is going crazy at the moment, amazing episodes, but they're doing a live show on August 10th in London. So I'll talk about that in a bit. But for now, this is episode 153 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Sophia Bertella. I'm putting my headphones out already. I'm here today with Sophia Bertella. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm all right. Have I pronounced your name right there? I always worry when it's not a simple...
Say it again.
Sophia Bertella.
Bertella, yeah.
Bertella.
Yeah, Sophia Bertella.
That's good.
Yeah.
And we're in LA and I'm delighted you've had time to come and chat with me because it must be manic for you right now.
Yes.
I've been in LA a week and I was saying this and you've not seen it all, but I've seen your face at least 10 times a day because you're on every billboard and yeah, it's all about to happen. So
yeah, I heard. I personally haven't seen them. I think every time I'm in the car, I'm on the phone because I have to catch up with some emails.
Yeah,
it's been a bit crazy. I don't look at my emails while I'm driving.
That's good.
Because I'm working every day. I have a driver coming and picking me up. I actually don't own a car right at the moment.
Yeah,
which is strange. But
so in LA, you need to have a driver then, because
yeah,
it's
impossible to walk around and try to have something spontaneous happen to you. You go from one point to another,
yeah, completely.
And you have to have it planned, sort of thing.
Yeah,
that's the downside, I think, of LA. It's hard, like in New York or Paris, London, you can walk around
and find stuff and stumble upon stuff,
exactly, or upon people,
yeah,
and have your day taken from that point on.
Yeah,
and I miss that aspect of my life when I'm in LA a bit.
It's weird. Why do you think LA is like that? Is it because of how spread out it is, I guess, that there's not that kind of just you're going to this particular area or this district, it's so spread out that you are going to one place in this area and one place there?
Exactly, yeah. I think there are specific areas where you choose and decide where you can hang out, and they have different sort of identity and style about them, whether you're in West Hollywood or Silver Lake or North Hollywood. But yeah, you go to a specific place and it's very rare to see people just strolling around.
Yeah.
And I think the way that the city is set up in and where not necessarily shops, but like restaurants or cafes are, they're all very far apart from each other, from one another. And so And so that, and yeah, LA is a very big city.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's a massive grid.
Because the first, see it, yeah,
from the airplane when you land, you realize what kind of
how like, vast mad, it is.
Yeah, cubicle sort of city it is.
And it is one. I think you're right. It's not one that you can stumble upon things so easy. The first two times I came to LA, I wasn't a fan of it. I didn't like it at all. And then I came here with people. And then I knew people from here, mm-hmm. and suddenly I saw this amazing city that was great because mm-hmm. they knew where we were going and what was mm-hmm. going on, and it opens it up a bit more.
Yeah, it is a city that doesn't invite much spontaneity.
Yeah.
That's one thing about this place. But I think if you know the right people and you find the good group of people that you get along with, I think you can have a good experience, and it can be also an awful one if you're all of a sudden in the wrong areas, or if you're with people that just don't suit you. I mean, there is, I think, people for everyone here, and I think there's all sort of style. Or, if you look for art, if you look for nature, there's all that sort of aspect that this city can definitely invite. I also miss, you know, walking around and having a sense of history, and time. It's a very young place, and I do miss that when I walk around in London. I think, visually, you know, putting your eyes on some, you know, 1,000-year-old church, or it's gratifying. I grew up in that sort of context, so not having that that access in LA is, if you're used to it, I'd say it could be a bit strange.
Yeah, it's a weird one. The first time I came to America, it made me then appreciate London more, and going around Europe even made me appreciate that London is also a beautiful city, because I would go on tour, and if we're in, I always remember just one in particular. I go into Metz in France, and it had the most beautiful architecture and things like that. And I was like, right, I've got that at home as well, but because I've lived there my whole life, I've taken it for granted. And then you come to America, and you're like, everything's 100 years old at most, and you don't have that excitement there.
Absolutely, yeah.
How long have you been in LA?
But you have access to nature, and that's beautiful. Yeah. I like that where you live, that you can go on hikes in beautiful places, and you can go to the beach, and that's nice. That aspect is nice. It's still a desert. Yeah.
You can go from canyon to being in the middle of the ocean in moments.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that.
So you live kind of out here and in Paris still?
No, I don't, actually.
Where are you located?
I moved here 11 years ago.
11 years ago, wow.
Quite spontaneously, actually. Yeah. I was on tour with Madonna, my first tour.
Yeah.
And we were in Tokyo. And at the time, me and my mom lost our home,
right,
where we lived. And I told her to just take something for herself and not worry about me. And
oh, wow.
We have rehearsed that tour in LA that time.
Mm.
And I had about 2 or 3 more months on my visa. And just, you know, I as a dare, I told myself, I'll just go there and see, not necessarily to move, but I thought I'd stay here for a few months. And I ended up just working on my another visa, which I had and was approved. And I ended up staying. And I thought, when I was younger, I took acting classes in Paris. And I thought, you know, it's the place. Why not take classes and go back to the theater? And I found an amazing teacher, Arthur Mendoza. And he taught Stella Adler at this little theater called ACT, Actor Circle Theater.
Yeah.
This theater doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, wow.
But I studied there for about 5-6 years.
That's amazing.
On and off when I wasn't dancing, working. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. So what was your upbringing? Where did you grow up with your mum? You're Algerian,
mm-hmm.
right? So were you in I know, obviously, when... So you would have been born around 20 to 30 years after the civil war there and the uprising. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of Algerians moved, the French Algerian, in over to France. So what was your kind of, where were you in all of that as your youth?
I grew, should I close this?
If you like, it's up to you.
Would it be loud?
No, it's fine. It's nice to have some atmosphere.
you're right. Let's have some a bit of LA atmosphere in the back.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have some atmosphere once you hear the sirens.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're super loud in LA. Sometimes I'm on the phone with people and it feels like the fire truck just ram into my apartment.
In LA, I sleep with earplugs in. Just because it's everywhere. Everywhere I've ever stayed is noisy. I've never found somewhere that's kind of a bit quiet and...
there are some places, but definitely here, not on this artery here.
In the middle of it all.
Yeah, I was born in Algeria about exactly 20 years after Algeria gained its independence in 1962.
Yeah.
I was born in 82. So from the war, from Algeria being France.
French.
But when I was born, we left Algeria because of the civil war.
Yeah.
And
huge amounts
10.
Did, right? Like, I'm sure it was like almost a million or so people left because it was it a 9-year war or a 12-year war? It was a long period of time that it was a battle to get your country back, essentially. So
It was like, it was, I mean, Algeria was colonized for over 100 years.
Yeah,
by France. Crazy. My parents were born French. I was born Algerian. But then there was a civil war then at the time when I was a kid, and at the time a lot of people were trying to leave the country.
Yeah.
And we were me and my mom were one of the few luckiest one who were able to leave without really a struggle.
Yeah.
But I remember I went to school one morning and I came back to the apartment and it was empty, and my parents wouldn't tell me that we would leave, because I would tell everybody and it would be known. And my dad spoke against that political party that were extremist, and it wasn't safe anymore. But they wouldn't tell me, because I would tell everybody. Because I don't think, you know what, when you're 10 years of age, you realize what's happening or the stakes.
No, you're not going to have the understanding of...
Yeah,
of,
but I've been to France at the time a few times with my father, who already lived in France.
Mm.
And Paris had some sort of aspect that, you know, where you're a kid, you felt like, I felt like we had access to everything in France, because of silly things like there wasn't Coca-Cola in Algeria or bananas or candies, like, you know, flowing at the shop.
Yeah.
And I was wildly excited until I moved to France and realized what a gap it was and everything that I had to catch up. I knew I wasn't a popular kid.
Right.
And at all in France. And that's when I think little by little I've experienced quite a culture shock.
Yeah, yeah. So that kind of dream perception of this wonderful place you're going to, without the realization that when you get there you don't know anyone and you're not the same as everyone else, and there's something different about you, or your level of education or level of whatever else is going to be slightly different and have gone on a different tangent. So
yeah, absolutely. And you know, I didn't realize that this was going to happen at all. I came in the picture quite naively, thinking, you know, when I was in Algeria, we used to make soccer balls out of paper.
Yeah,
we would smash paper on top of each other and would tape them, and this was enough and fine and fun, actually. Yeah. You know, and in France it was very much about other things, and part of me felt like I need to catch up with all of that, because I think it's survival, and I think you know ultimately you want to belong, and it's hard when you're a kid to be wise and think I don't care or think it doesn't matter. It takes a while for this aspect to take place and to have the wiseness or the maturity to think that it shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come without a sense of insecurity or a sense of, you know, feeling that you're, you know, trying to catch up with something, running after something that seems so big at the time. But but I think ultimately, you know, it helped me a great deal because I did catch up with my time, because I refused to, you know, I didn't victimize myself, and I refused to be behind.
Yeah.
Or to be left behind or not considered. And I think, you know, what helped me the most is dancing and expressing myself. That was a great relief, and I feel very lucky that I had that too, as an exutoire, how do you say, as an escape for me to feel like relevant and feel, you know, good enough.
Was that something you were already involved in and passionate about before you moved to France?
Yeah. I started ballet in Algeria, actually. Probably the only ballet school in the country.
Oh, wow.
And my teacher, Camille and Faouja, they were sisters, and I think one of them went to the Bolshoi, actually. And they were very serious and very good teachers, and I was in that school. My father, I think, have worked with one of them. And I was in this school, and when I moved to France, I asked if I could keep going, and I was lucky to be able to do so.
Yeah. And did France open you up more opportunity to a variation of styles of dance and things like that? Because I'd imagine if you're in one place in Algeria, if there's one there's one ballet school, then that's mm-hmm. all you'd know. Whereas mm-hmm. suddenly you're in a metropolis where yeah. there's all sorts of variation.
Yeah, it's frightening.
Yeah.
When there's that many options, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
it's sometimes easier to not have those options. So it's like, oh, yeah. here's what I do.
Yeah.
You don't have to make a choice. Yeah, you just exactly. do that.
Yeah, sometimes restrictions are blessings,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
But, and having the choice to, I mean, and my personality also, I want to try everything a lot of the time. So I, by elimination, I know what's good. So,
yeah.
I think, you know, I did ballet and then I came to France, I did ballet and I was in rhythmic gymnastics as well.
Yeah.
But everything I've done was very more on the strict side.
Yeah.
In that sense. But I wanted to have a bit of sense of freedom
yeah.
in my dancing. And some dancers that I've met that were in that dance school were hip hop dancers, and I was fascinated by yeah. what they were able to do, and their sense of freedom was staggering
yeah.
for me. I envy them, and I wanted to do that. And most of them were men, and I was wondering, why isn't there more women there?
Yeah.
And then whenever I would see women coming there, I would see the men just trying to chase them and
right.
trying to be, you know, hook up yeah. with them. And I was like, yeah. hey, I don't want to have that dynamic. I really want to learn, and I'm going to do it. And in a rebellious way, I wanted to do hip hop, and
yeah.
so I dressed like a tomboy, and
yeah.
I put my hair in a hat because I wanted to learn. I didn't want to attract attention any other
yeah.
way than just for the art, and I did that for a few years.
Yeah.
But that was just a way to rebel against everything that I've learned. That was far more academic.
It's got to be so a great combination, though, because the root in dance forms that are far more strict and disciplined. So when you're then approaching a form that's got that bit more freedom, you've still got that work ethic and
yeah.
discipline to develop it and learn it
yeah.
quickly. And mm-hmm. I always remember when I had Riz Ahmed on the podcast, he was saying he was really disheartened after his first few films or TV things he did, because he drilled his lines, got everything perfect, and the first two or three he turned up and they pretty much threw the script away and improvised it all. And his mind was, I've worked really hard to learn all of this and get it all tight.
But you know
and
what?
We're just making it up.
But then he has it in his back pocket.
That's exactly what he said. He said he still does that now, because he's like, right, even though he knows half the time it's going to be thrown away, he's got that. So when they
yeah.
need to, if what they're improvising isn't finding its spot,
mm-hmm.
he's got that
mm-hmm.
that worked out script mm-hmm. to fall back on and go, no, I know it back to front. I've got this,
yes,
I've got this
yeah.
covered.
Yeah, because he knows what he's talking about. It's
yeah.
not about the lines at all.
Yeah.
I think all the work he's done probably gave him a good sense of what it is about. So improvisation is like widely invited at that
yeah.
point. Yeah, when I started doing hip-hop, because I was wildly flexible.
Yeah.
And a lot of the dancers were telling me, no, do this and do that. And I wanted to put aside completely everything that I've learned. And I wanted to learn the basics of and then there are basics movement in hip-hop and,
yeah.
and in breakdancing more specifically
yeah.
and I just wanted to drill those moves, and then once I felt that I had the sense of them and I was able to do them technically as correctly as I could, you know, I was bringing my aspect and I think my oddness, and I made it my style and my
yeah.
own. But I wanted yeah I think the discipline
it's the discipline of getting that route rather
yeah.
than going
yeah
I want to be jumping off or fast
yeah.
forwarding straight
yeah.
to this point.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating one. I was talking to a brother about this recently, and that kind of discipline is something that's lost more and more in the world today, because mm-hmm. we have so many windows to the end point,
mm-hmm.
so we can see where we want to be and we want to fast forward there. And I think it was Socrates originally. If you studied under Socrates, you weren't allowed to ask a question for the first 3 years.
Mm.
So for 3 years in his classes, you had to listen, because it was deemed that you're not worthy of questioning until you've had 3 years of listening. And again, that's something that I loved hearing that, but equally
that
couldn't happen now.
That
couldn't happen now.
Yeah.
You know, is it, that kind of discipline is lost.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I completely agree with that, and I adopt that. I did not know that story, but I'll look into that.
Yeah, it's a good approach.
It is interesting. I feel like I adopt that in everything that I do, because I need to learn the basics. Like even the teacher that I've had in acting
yeah.
and the way I've learned and the way I wanted to develop my career in terms of acting, I always thought, you know, I want to to be there for the right reasons, but also because I've learned and I feel like I have a good knowledge on it, not because I came in that world through the exit door.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think I just don't, me personally, work well that way.
Yeah, completely. I think that's, again, it's something that comes from coming from any kind of a working class or impoverished kind of start or as, again, the life of finding yourself as an immigrant in France is that thing that you've always had to earn, earn everything. So you kind of, the stuff that you get, the value almost becomes what you did to get it rather than the actual thing.
Absolutely.
So the prize isn't the expensive car you've got. The prize is all the work you've done to get that expensive car and that kind of,
that's the real payoff. Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. Yeah. It's very dear to me and important. And I worked with somebody who means a lot to me, and I asked her an advice, and she said, anything you get fast, you'll lose fast.
Yeah.
And she said, earning what you're doing will only invite longevity and truth into your work. And that marked me very much. And I try to adopt that in everything I do.
Yeah.
Sometimes people ask me questions about my opinion on certain things, and very easily I say, without any fear or insecurity of not knowing, that I said, I haven't gone to that yet.
Yeah.
And I feel like whenever I do, I feel like I need to research or to study far more than I have. Better, fortunately or unfortunately for that cause, but fortunately for others, for other ones that I've been spending time in other genre trying to perfect these other areas in my life that I feel like I need to. But in anything I do, people I work with, the people that represent me or friends, and I ask a lot of questions because I don't like not knowing.
Yeah.
Not knowing, because I think when I moved to France...
That must be so refreshing in this industry, though, because much from what I've seen in the acting industry is people always wanting to give the impression that... that they know everything and they know what they're doing and they're meant to be there. It's something, and not to compare, but it's something that I went down really well when I was doing Taboo, because I'd ask if I could stay and watch when they'd wrapped me, because I've not had years of acting class and I need to be learning as much as I can rather than going to a hotel room and sitting there and having room service. It's like, well, if Tom Hardy is here and Stephen Graham and Tom Hollander and loads of people I respect, I'd like to sit and watch and learn and kind of take as much in as possible. And that seems to go down well, because again, everyone tends to be turning up with their chest puffed out to give the impression that I'm equal to everyone, I've achieved everything. So the ability to ask questions and say, can you explain why we're doing this or what this is, that's a refreshing thing, right?
I think so. I do it every time.
Yeah.
And I think I've come across different kind of people. People that said yes, of course, and they were eager to share with me their knowledge. Yeah. And I've come across people who thought my questioning was second guessing their own their own knowledge, and me not trusting that. I said no, not at all. I come across, maybe it's my French accent or the tone of my voice as being a bit direct. It's not that. It's just that I don't go around saying things I don't sugarcoat my wording. I'm polite, I think, but I bluntly ask questions, what is this? And I think that's how I survived when I moved to France.
Yeah.
That was the only way to survive, was to ask questions, so no, and catch up with that. And same thing when I moved to America.
Yeah.
When I first started working with Madonna, my English was very poor.
Yeah.
It was not great at all. And I had to, like, the methods of working were very different. And I think... As dancing is being a mute form of communication, you know, not very much voice but very much physicalized. I thought I have to learn about all these things, and I have to speak louder, and I have to be understood, and I need to understand others. So I bothered, what is this? What is that? How do you say this? In which context? And try and read as much as possible. But that's all survival.
Yeah,
I think.
Completely, it's making it so that you can be in this situation for as long a time as possible. If you sit there quietly pretending you understand everything, then you're going to miss loads and fall out of that situation, right? Whereas if you address the bits you don't understand as quickly as possible, then you've got that now.
Yeah.
You've got that and you can move on.
I think so.
So what was the route, the path from Algerian immigrant trained ballet dancer sneaking into becoming a street dancer to touring with Madonna and working with all sorts of pop acts? And
I know it's
how did that all come about?
I know it's a bit of a maze when I look back at it. I think I still have the sequence of order in my head.
Yeah.
Because I think it came all, it could have been all messy, but I think I've made decisions early on to, so it wasn't messy, but it came out of sequence, I mean, out of, in different orders.
Right.
Then since I'm 5, started acting when I was 17, a friend of mine told me there was this audition and Blanca Lee, a Spanish choreographer, was going to direct this musical and ended up booking it.
Yeah.
And I booked a love interest to the lead guy, and I had to dance, and I absolutely adored acting.
Yeah.
And I think what I liked about it is the fact that I think I've always danced from the same place that I've, from what I found in acting.
Yeah.
I've danced from, of course, a place of emotion, but also a place of story. And I've always had a story, even though, you know, you could see just technical moves, but I've always made up a story. But and then I took acting classes and I did a few projects until the age of 18, but I wasn't a commercial dancer. In France, I never worked with artists, and I wasn't doing TV at all. I was in a very underground hip-hop group called Vagabond, and I would do shows in theaters, but it was not like what I've done after later on. And then I auditioned for Nike and I ended up booking that.
Right.
And the director, the choreographer for that at the time was doing Madonna's, I've been directing Madonna's shows for the past 10 or so years.
Yeah.
And so he took me on Madonna straight from that. So I haven't had a lot of experience when I started working with her.
Yeah.
And she's a bit avant-garde like that. I consider myself lucky that I worked with her for so long and at such a young age. But she likes to discover people.
Yeah.
I mean, when she met me, I was a complete tomboy. I remember she came to me once and she asked me if I've ever danced in heels before, and I said no, and she gave me a pair of heels that were very fancy and beautiful, and she said there's a beginning for everything, and she handed Amazing. Them to me, and she taught me a huge amount.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, she's the main artist and person that I've worked with as a dancer.
Yeah. It's beautiful hearing this, because from the outside it speaks to what you were saying about the preparation and discipline, because from the outside you've been plucked almost out of nowhere by Nike and then Madonna has found you and all this, but in reality you've been preparing for that since you were 5 and training and getting yourself, so whilst there is some luck and moments, it's luck that you've prepared yourself to have and trained yourself to have, so when that opportunity does come you can make the most of it and turn it into a career, rather than an opportunity comes and you just, it's there and it's gone.
It's funny how luck is a subjective one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you work for your luck.
Yeah, I agree completely. You're right.
I don't think I've ever realized that I was working or for to get to anywhere.
Yeah.
To get anywhere specifically. I've never did things to have a specific outcome from them.
Yeah.
Generally, from an artistic standpoint, I just felt strongly towards some discipline that I really needed to exert and to live and go through. But I always thought I prefer to dance the way I truly feel and have another job if it's to make money. But I never thought I want to make money with that genre no matter what, and I'll just substitute what I truly love in order to, you know, I never made the connection, and it was two separate things.
Yeah.
I really, I've always felt passionate about the thing that I engage in, and I wanted to stick to that because it felt like almost vital.
Yeah.
And the same way that I stopped acting, because I knew I cared about it, but I knew I wasn't done with dancing. And I felt like I had my butt between two chairs, and being indecisive was not a good, didn't make me feel strong and didn't make me feel solid in my choices, and so made me feel weak in any genre that I was getting involved in.
Yeah.
So I stopped.
Yeah, go on.
So I stopped at the age of 19 just to solely dance and to dedicate my time in that properly.
Yeah. I mean, just from the conversations so far, that makes perfect sense, because it feels like you're someone that is so focused and disciplined that exactly that. You can't really do two things at once, because you need to give 100% to one thing. And from that, I mean 100% of everything. Like, not 100% of when I'm doing my art stuff, 100% of this is my living and breathing. So that isn't something that you can split between the two. Mm-hmm. Or was it ever an issue, because, as you were saying, you in your mind, potentially, your dancing was your passion and your art, and you were assuming you were going to have some other job that pays the bills. Or was it ever an issue, because it can be tough when the thing that is your passion becomes your living and your earning. Did that ever take any of the joy away from it and the pleasure away from it when it's your day-to-day job, essentially?
I think I have been, once again, like you put it earlier, lucky.
Yeah.
In that sense, because I was still with my parents when I was in Paris.
Yeah.
And I was with that group, Vagabond.
Yeah.
But then I started working with Nike and making money for myself.
Yeah.
And then I worked for Madonna, and then I saved money.
Yeah.
And that's how I was able to come here and move to America. And meanwhile, I was still working with Nike. And so I was lucky to be able to be independent early on in my life. And I feel very grateful for that. And I've always been grateful. But I had the same dilemma when I moved here and started taking acting classes, because I thought, after a while, am I hiding behind the fact that I'm dancing and I've been pretty lucky at it so far, but I really love acting, and I felt like I need to flip the coin the other way around now, but I still didn't feel ready internally. But I've stressed the question for about 2-3 years, whether I stop dancing or I just solely act, and I would ask people around me, not because I wanted people to tell me what to do, but more essentially because it's interesting to me to see what people do when they're facing dilemmas like that.
Yeah.
And hearing people's opinion or people's stories, I thought, was a good way to then me come up with my own answer and how I truly felt. And I bothered, and it seemed to be a question of life or death, bizarrely enough. It was so important.
Yeah.
And I genuinely woke up one morning, and the need and the feel of keeping dancing was gone, and I could not explain why. But I do that in life in general, whether it's on anything that I care about that is in my heart deeply, whether it's a person, an art form, or anything that is important to me. I stress the subject and I question. I live in it and with it until it's gone. But I don't forget, you know, and move on and forgive. I remember and I've learned, and I feel better that way as a person. So I needed to come up with an answer, and I knew I wasn't going to do both.
Right.
And I thought, how much longer am I going to stay in this situation? So when I woke up, I was over the moon, and I had no plans specific. And I remember we were rehearsing for the Super Bowl with Madonna, and we were at Madison Square Garden. And I remember I emailed her and I said, I'd love to talk to you before rehearsal today. When she's always been lovely and dear to me and close as a friend, but like when we work. So I sent her an email. I said, I'd love to talk to you. And she came to me and she said, are you pregnant? I said, no, I am not pregnant. I said, I just want to say that I think I'm not going to dance anymore. I'm going to do this. And I love her to bits, and I wasn't going to stop at all what I've started. It wasn't a question of that, but I knew the feeling was gone. And she asked me, did you book? She always encouraged me to act, and we always talked about acting.
Yeah.
And she asked me, did you book a movie? And I said, no, I haven't booked anything.
Yeah.
And she said, what if you don't work for the next 8 months, which is the tour, what it had to offer. It's sort of that sort of time length, 8 months to a year. And I said, even if it takes 2 years, I feel like I need to put my head and heart in that completely. And she said, I like that. And she supported me, and she said, we said bye in a professional way, and it was lovely.
I love that.
And then
that's
stayed
beautiful.
In touch. But if there's a God, he heard me, because it took 2 years to book one job, and I didn't make a paycheck in 2 years.
Yeah.
And it was hard towards the end. I thought about all sort of things. I thought about how can I make money quickly and without jeopardizing the time that I need to spend in acting. I've been auditioning the whole time, being in class, meetings. I just haven't booked anything in 2 years. And I ended up booking, yeah, Kingsman 2 years after that.
Yeah,
but wow. People have told me, you know, over weekends, there's this music videos, you want to do it, you could have made such amount of money, and it would have helped me massively at times. But I knew I couldn't do something that had to do with the previous art form. It's just like when you break up with, you know, with a boyfriend, you're not just going to go back out of... I don't feel that way. It's too important. So I love... dancing too much to do it just as a side thing.
As a bit every now and then. Yeah. It needs
and
to be all in
or
all out.
I thought of doing that because I could have been on my own in mornings, do a house a day. And I thought at the end of the week where I have like $700 and that was good for
and
me.
And you can work lines and techniques.
You're left alone. But I thought, you know, how, you know, as a waitress is too stressful and I don't think you make enough money. And I thought, what if I do go-go dancing, but it's just too close to dancing. Yeah, I never took the job that was the music video. I could have not done that.
It's fascinating though, because again, I don't mean to be as if I'm psychoanalyzing or going into anything, but it feels that if it took 2 years to book the next job, the way you seem to be is you will have got 2 years better in that time. Do you know what I mean? You would have been improving yourself. It's not like it's 2 years of sitting around and waiting. It's 2 years of perfecting the art form even more. So it's not a wasted 2 years as such.
No, it was not completely not. No, right. I was living, breathing and acting constantly. And those 2 years didn't come without stress. And many times I've wondered, what have I done? Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem that I had any other choice.
Yeah.
And I never reconsidered. And I never thought... I've done a mistake, and I never thought would I go back to dancing ever. Yeah. I never thought of that. I never considered choreographing. I never had that in my heart. Yeah. And I, for some reason, I didn't seem to have much choice but to keep going with whatever I started.
Yeah, it's then. If you've made that decision.
Yeah, but it wasn't not out of ego. It wasn't out of like, okay, I'm sticking to my decision because of that. It seemed like something was pushing me from the back, and I had something was stirring this, and I just had to follow that path.
Yeah.
I have no idea what it was. It seemed like I didn't have much choice, and I knew it was deeply anchored in my heart, and I had to finish that, and I had to be in it.
That's amazing. And Kingsman was a huge... iconic and show ceiling, and it's where I first became aware of you. I was a big fan of that film, and that was an amazing role to get right, because it was such a strong character, such a distinctive character. So how was it when that came about after 2 years? How did that feel, and how was it approached?
Yeah, so Kate Buckley, my lovely agent, who we talked about earlier.
She's amazing.
I was communicating a lot with her at the time. She was my only agent.
Yeah.
And I was here in LA and she was in London. So the
to give some context there of why we were discussing, Kate was the first person that gave me any advice on the acting front, and she didn't have to. I didn't know her at all. Like, we had some mutual friends, and she just said, look, just come and meet me and we'll have a drink and I'll give you some advice and tips. And it was purely, again, out of her own kindness and generosity. So
she's a strong, tough woman, and I owe her a great deal. And I love her to bits. But yeah, so Kate, the dance that we were having at the time, her and I, was that because she's in London, so she would send me material during her day, and so it's the nighttime for me, and I would wake up to a lot of things to work on, and there wasn't a day where I didn't have an audition or a meeting.
Amazing.
And so I woke up one morning and I had the audition for Kingsman, and so I did. I prepared for it, and I went, and it went well. You know, she called back and said it went well. They like just said, okay, good. And then you have to learn very often. You know, and I think I learned that early on as a dancer, also to be able to do your best at an audition and leave it behind and not wait or having any sort of expectation.
100%.
And that's a learning process. I think that it takes a bit of a while. To not be deceived or feel, you know, the deception if you don't get something. But I was like, okay, good, I've done my job.
I see them as a workshop to go and work on a character.
Exactly.
And then walk away. I've only got one, which I won't go into now, but I'll tell you about afterwards, that I went to and I wasn't able to do that. I kind of went in and I was so obsessed with that role and all of that that I walked away kind of like, I need to know and it's one that I've still not heard, and it's not been covered, and it's one of them. It's the one. Every other one I've been able to let go and go in exactly that kind of.
If you want it too much, it's dangerous. Almost.
Yeah, yeah.
So you end up getting the ones that you don't, that you're able to let go.
Exactly.
It's funny. Yeah, it's always that way. It's really interesting. But I thought, you know, at that level, and especially if I was ever auditioning for a big project, I thought I was realistic and lucid enough to know that at that point, you know, there is a credit factor, there is an accent factor, and there's a look factor. I never fit in any box.
Right.
But all I wanted to do is do well inside the room for casting and be a good actress, you know, as much as I could. And I thought, you know, I don't get to work and make, you know, be on a job right at the moment, but this is the way to practice.
Yeah, completely. You know? And it's great because, in a way, if you've got a distinctive look or distinctive accent or anything, it almost makes it easier for you to do it and move on, because there's stuff outside of your control that could be the reason you've not got it. You're not that right look or that right person. But the thing that I've learned kind of early on is caring about the room rather than the project.
Absolutely.
Wanting to make a good impression with that cast. If I feel that we got on really well and I did the character how I wanted to to do it, then that's that job done. I don't care too much about if I get it or not. It's making that impression in that moment. Because again, similarly, I'm 6'4" and I've got a big beard. That's not going to work everywhere. So there's going to be certain things that I'll feel I smashed it on the day, but it goes upstairs and they're like, no, why would we put that huge person into our film?
The only way that it becomes personal and you would feel personally about it is if, like, you know, you haven't worked hard enough and you know that you haven't done spend enough time with it. And that's when I think it turns into a nightmare, this whole experience. But if you know you've worked hard enough.
If you feel you've left something not there, not done.
Yeah. But that's what the thing now is with taping. I think, you know, when you walk into a room, you're able to change the temperature in a room. That's the power that you have when you go inside. And now sometimes you have to tape.
Yeah.
And you have to do that sort of on your own.
Yeah.
And I really like when I'm able to go in the room. At first I thought, what an amazing thing. I get to control us and the best take.
Yeah.
And no, I think I like much better. And also I used to put myself in costume, complete context, costume, makeup. And at some point Kate had to tell me, you have to stop doing that.
Yeah.
Because you're suppressing their way, their ability to imagine you. Because if they have an idea and you come with another idea that's too strong, you have to wear, you know, t-shirt black, white, and then just be as plain. Like, you need to be a canvas and do the acting.
So they can then interpret.
Do the acting with your rhythm.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to understand that. But I think during 2 years, I didn't have an opportunity to act. So I think I was just putting on a play.
Yeah.
And I was
having
fun.
I'm just enjoying myself at home.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's perfect. No, I get that completely, though. The initial thought would be, I guess it also then becomes that you've got a background in performing live. So you've got that experience of having to just do it in the moment and on the day. Therefore, going in for an audition, you've got that comfort of I'll do it in that one go. Whereas if you're at home and said you could do take after take after take, it can lose a bit of that energy that you would have of going on stage or going you know, in that room.
And then also you get used to a level of control that you don't get to have once you're on set with a film director. So I think it's good to be able to let go and share the experience
point.
Of other people that are in control and have that sort of collectiveness happen. And you can do that with casting directors.
Yeah.
When you're on your own having to do your tape, you feel for a second that you have a sense of control, but then that's not how this business works.
Yeah.
As an actor.
Yeah.
But, so I woke up one morning to a bunch of emails. So the audition went well.
Yeah.
And Kate said, and I said, great, done my job, you know. And the next day, that was a Wednesday.
Yeah.
The next day I wake up on a Thursday, she had emailed me, you have to fly this afternoon. I woke up at 9, she said, you have to fly this afternoon to meet with Matthew once you land. On Friday. And you have to work on all your scenes. And it wasn't much for Gazelle. They've added a few. But she said, work on all your scenes, read the whole script. And you have to pack for 5 months in case you book it. But you might come back on Saturday.
Oh, wow.
So I woke up at nine in the morning having to do laundry and prepare myself to to leave for that long, but I might come back in 2 days. It was a bit hectic.
It was exciting. It's a weird industry as well, though, where you have to just accept that in all of those situations, it's a yes. Mm-hmm. It's a yes. Like, it can't be a, well, no, I can't. It always has to be, yeah, okay, I'm there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going. I'm good to go.
Yeah.
I drop everything. So how was that then, turning up and knowing that, but that's that pressure is on it, I guess.
I think that's, you know,
Am I going home tomorrow?
I always feel like a suitcase away from anything, and I'm always up for an adventure. So my energy is way up for, you know, for these things.
Yeah.
From the get go, and I feel like I've adopted that from a young age, having to move around with the parents or have never staying in the same place, and you know, very much long. So that came across as. I loved it and I was excited and something was happening.
Yeah.
And even if it turned out that I had to come back on Saturday, it was stressful.
Yeah.
But I felt, you know, then this is what's going to happen and that's it. It's fine. So I landed. I've read the whole script in the plane and I learned all my lines.
Amazing.
And I landed in London on Friday morning and I went straight to Shepperton and read for Matthew and he just saw two scenes and in a very cool way. He said, okay, I'm happy. Now we just need to talk to producers and agent. And my inside was screaming with joy. And I just kept the cool face.
Yeah.
And I had to go to the bathroom and I just had to scream.
Amazing.
And I just called. I called my parents first. I called my dad because they were worried about me. My family was worried.
Yeah.
And I said, I booked a job. And they had no idea that I was in London.
Yeah.
That I was doing all this audition. I told nobody.
Yeah.
That I was leaving. Not even my friends from L.A. And,
it's a weird one, isn't it? It's kind of the best way, particularly if you are, for you to be able to treat each job in the way that you were just saying, if you turn up, you do it and you forget about it, you have to be quite private about it. Because if you're saying to your friends or family, oh, I'm in for this, then you're not allowed to go in, do your job and forget about it. Because people are going, oh, have you heard back about
Kingsman? It's very stressful.
Have you heard back about
this? Yeah. And then you have to relive the deception of not having had it. If people ask you,
I never heard back on that.
I tend to never tell when I have an audition. And it's not out of, I'm not superstitious at all. I'm happily sharing. It's just that I can't talk about it. There's too much.
I get that completely. Yeah. I understand that. Mm-hmm. So you booked it and you held in the excitement at the time. And then how was that? Were you away for 5 months?
I was. I trained for quite a while and then we shot. And then I booked another one. I overlapped another project that took me to India.
Yeah.
And then I came back to LA. And then something else happened is that after that, I didn't work for about a year.
Right.
Again. And I remember, I came back to LA and I stayed here for a year before about a year before I booked Star Trek.
Yeah.
But I remember promoting Kingsman and being on the red carpet and looking amazing like a princess, but I was overdrawn $2,000 on my account.
Right.
That was a weird contrast as well.
Yeah.
Like, this is crazy. I'm promoting a movie that's huge with amazing actors and I feel like I'm never going to work ever again.
Yeah. It's that weird fiction, isn't it?
That
this town in particular kind of sells. Mm-hmm.
That was the premiere in London.
Right, yeah. So how was it to get Star Trek? And again, that was, the reboot had been a huge success and was amazing. And then you're getting to come in as a cool as fuck alien. And you know what I mean? To get to be this cool kind of a badass character as such. How was that and how did that all...
So I was auditioning here in LA, and again, I was terrified I wasn't going to work again.
Yeah,
and that I had also a lot of attention in the promotion process of Kingsman,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like it wasn't deserved because the acting was so little in the film itself.
Yeah,
although the character was
it was a striking character and a striking role, but it is a minimal.
Yeah, it is minimal, and I love how striking she is, and I love playing her. But I thought, it's above me, you know, sort of thing. And I need to catch up with that sort of level.
Right,
you know,
I had
even more pressure on myself. And on top of, like, trying to not, like, paying my rent.
You know,
and I went to this audition at Paramount and I had no idea what it was for. And I came back for a call back and I had to sign my contract before I did my callback.
it was crazy.
And I still had no idea what project it was for. I mean, there were speculations, and we assumed that it might have been that because the sides were from other sci-fi films.
Right.
And we thought that, you know, because they were coming back with the third one. But I had no idea it was an alien, not sure that it was Star Trek.
I love the weird vagueness of these things when it's people involved. Mm-hmm. I had one where I just literally had to record a few different American accents. I've still never found out what it was because I didn't get it. But I just had to do a few different accents and send it off. But it was a similar, they're like, we can't tell you.
Yeah.
We can't let you know anything unless you get an... It's like, man.
Actually, no, sorry, my bad. For the callback... I did not know what project it was. I didn't have to sign something quite yet. And then I did a screen test.
Right.
And I had to sign a screen test. I did a screen test knowing that it was for Star Trek, but not knowing what character I was playing.
Right.
So I signed it. And then I went in the makeup bus and they said, this is what you're going to look like. I was like, whoa.
Oh, wow.
I thought, yeah, this is fantastic. It's amazing. I love transforming and I embrace that. And then I was taken on a journey in Vancouver for 4 months, shooting with an amazing group of people.
So how was it experience-wise in comparison? Because Kingsman was big, but it still had the feel of more of an independent type big film, whereas Star Trek is Star Trek. You know, it's this huge franchise.
Yeah. But, you know, the boys in Star Trek have been around together for quite a while, and they've you know, they've experienced two together.
Yeah.
And there's strong family. I think I was a bit nervous at first to jump into that family because I knew how tight they were, and I think I could tell.
Yeah.
And when I met them the first day, I saw, you know, what a group, you know, they're solid.
Yeah.
And I was like, how am I going to find my space in that? And they just took me under their wings.
You're arriving in Paris again, and you're looking at the street dancers and thinking, I want to be them. See? But how do I get in?
How do I fit in?
Can I put my hair under a hat to get into Star Trek? How's that? Oh, what's the hat I have to put on to get in with the gang?
Yeah. Maybe what protected me is the alien face. Once again, I played an alien.
Yeah,
see?
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've been an alien all my life.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it works perfectly.
So no, I mean, I think the human experience on Star Trek was far, far more significant than the actual project itself. Bizarrely enough, as much as I love the project and the franchise, and the honor to be a part of the film, I think the human connection that I've made on with the cast was far more profound, and especially after, you know, Anton leaving us.
Yeah.
That was very significant, and
they're
incredible people, and we were very close, and I love them all to bits.
Yeah, that's great. And I've spoken in the past with Simon Pegg, and he always spoke of it's not, he said he had that with Star Trek and with Mission Impossible, weirdly, that it's like it's not a question for him. That's kind of, or even it's not a job for him or a project. It's like, no, that's the family and the group, and whenever they need me to do that, I go and do that, because that's an existence rather than a gig or I've got this role.
I feel the same way. I mean, I did not know, and I think I was scared, and I was a bit impressed.
Yeah,
you know, they're all such solid actors, But they made me feel. It felt like family, and it still does. We're still very close after we've wrapped. That was 2 years ago.
Yeah, wow.
So
what was after that? What's been the journey? Because you went on to Jet Trash after that, which was a far more independent thing.
Jet Trash was before.
Was it before? So you filmed that before, and then
Jet Trash was straight after Kingsman.
Oh, straight after.
That's
Kingsman.
That's what I went and filmed in India.
Oh, amazing!
Yeah.
So then, the next thing from Star Trek, would have been The Mummy or Atomic Blonde.
Actually, no. After Jet Trash, I went and filmed Tiger Raid.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, with Brian Gleeson and Damien Maloney.
Oh, amazing!
And we went back to Jordan for that.
Yeah.
And then I had Star Trek, and straight after Star Trek, I went on Atomic Blonde.
Yeah, which I saw the trailer. When I landed in LA, I had a spare afternoon. I went to see a film and saw the trailer. I'd read about it, hadn't seen the trailer. Pardon?
What did you go see?
I went to see King Arthur, and I went to see that because I was meant to be in it, and then I was cut from it, or told I was cut two weeks before it came out.
Oh, but you did film something.
Yeah, we filmed it all 3 years ago, and it was, but a whole story arc was taken out, and that happened to be all the bit that I was on. So, but I still wanted to see it because it was a similar thing. I had the most amazing experience. I loved everyone there. I got on really well and bonded with them. So I was like, I still want to see how it's turned out and be involved in that. But yeah, I saw the trailer for Atomic Blonde there, and it's one of the best trailers I've seen. Yeah, it's amazing.
I'm like, glad
you like the way it's edited, the music in it, and it's kind of a slow start, and then when it kicks in, it's an action, a music video almost. And yeah, it looked
It's a wall to wall movie. It's a wall to wall music in the film, and it's really, it's interesting. It was originally called The Coldest City, based on that
Graphic novel, isn't it? And the coldest. Winter was the prequel, wasn't it?
Yeah, that just came out.
Yeah.
They changed the title, I think, because it fit more the mood. And it's funny because it's a very cold film, but then all the colors like brings an interesting contrast to that whole mood, and the music also warmed the movie up. But I think it's a fun spy film that I enjoyed very much filming, and I was, all my scenes are with Charlize on that one, so it was less a sense of family on this one.
Right.
And we were in Budapest, and it was really cold, and everything was with her. It was more isolating as far as the project, but I embraced that. I think it was good for the part I played. It was good for. It was really good for the part. It served the character.
Cold spy type affair, then that's kind of a good thing. From the trailer, it feels like, I'm a fan of David Leitch. I think he's amazing, and his fingerprint comes across in that trailer hugely. It looks like it's so beautifully shot and well cut together and timed and everything. It feels like a real. Your heart rate is going to be going up and down throughout.
Yeah, the rhythm is powerful, and the edit is really cleverly done. Yeah. And he's really good with all his stunts and how it's raw and it's visceral.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that I'm not doing any action in that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I love that this man didn't see me as the go-to action girl, and I absolutely adore this. And Charlize in it is phenomenal. She's really kicking ass. Yeah. She's really strong.
Again, it's the beauty there of getting some roles that blew you up that are quite action-based, but having years and years of acting training and classes, so you're not just, you don't have to just be oh we need you to do a flip here or just be action.
That was my goal also, that was a part of my goal. I think I've been considered for some other dance roles, I think early on besides Street Dance 2 3D that I've done when I was 20 25 26 I think it's at the end of that film that I wondered if I should stop dancing.
Yeah.
You know, and then I stopped, but then I was
so approached. That you're not just the dancing actress as such.
But I've been approached for several dance projects, and I felt like I would enter this world through the exit door, and I wanted to learn again the basics and not be seen, and kind of like if people ever knew me as a dancer, that they forget that I was that.
Yeah.
And
it's kind of ideal because the roles you've got, and we'll get on to the Mummy now as well, where you've had, again, such an iconic look in as Gazelle and an alien in Star Trek, is it means that people can legitimately forget who you are at that point, if you know what I mean. It's not that kind of there you are. They're such striking images that it allows them to see the character rather than the actress, which is what you've got to strive for, right? If you're in love with the art of it. If you're in love with the idea of fame and celebrity, then you want to be seen. But if you can be lost as Sophia and just see the character up there, then that's got to be the ultimate goal. So,
yeah, I embrace transformations, and it's about the character, definitely not about me. And I think I've been lucky so far to have been given very sort of iconic character to play, and I embrace that completely. I think the time in the makeup chair is pretty difficult, but when you see the end result and when you realize that these characters cannot be played unless this sort of transformation is being made, it's so but I Yeah, but you know, even when I did Kingsman, I've never done any stunt in my life before. Yeah, so right. For Matthew to give me that opportunity is massive. And then auditioning for other projects and people thinking I come from the stunt world. No, I actually don't. But then being seen as such, it's like I need to remove myself from that. But not being an idiot at that point with that, I think it's about the material, the relationship and the script that you're reading and the story, the writers. So if it has to continually be, you know, action in the film that I do, it's as long as it's about the character and the film and the story. Yeah. I'm not going to turn my back on the project just because it has dancing or just because it has action in it. But it's about the material.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of iconic roles and characters and I'd imagine a decent amount of times in makeup, The Mummy is about to come out and that's a huge role for you. You're The Mummy, essentially, on all the billboards and everything. How was that as a project to work on? It's a reboot, obviously, so it's, I'd imagine going into it, there's a level of caution and wonder, but as long as you get a good script and a good team, then that gives you the confidence. How was that as a project to get involved in?
It came to me when I was actually finishing filming Star Trek.
Yep.
And I read the script and I told my agent, I don't feel that I'm ready for that.
Right.
And I said no to the project because as it was written initially, I just felt I'm going to go again through a lot of makeup to just play a monster that's walking around, just scaring people. And I'm a massive fan of the Lemmy movies.
Yeah.
I watched them when I was a teenager and I loved The Mummy. And I thought, you know, that it was, you know, it's such a beautiful, romantic sort of film, you know, that you see the mummy as the mummy for about 10 seconds at the beginning of the film and the rest of the film, you just see him as a human. Have no idea how he regenerated. There's a part of mystery that's being left in that film that invites your imagination to flourish. And I think that sometimes in movies nowadays, that aspect is a bit lost.
Yeah, completely.
And I thought, you know, I feel like I would have not felt happy if I was just a monster.
Yeah.
And I was also afraid that I will never work ever again.
Because I
looked at, you know, a few people who played monsters, if they were females, and what they have done after.
That's interesting.
I just had, again, for not having worked for so long, I felt maybe, you know, I'm never going to work after that one again.
Yeah.
So out of fear and out of coming from a movie that took me a lot, you know, that took a lot of time in the makeup chair, I said, maybe I should be patient and wait.
And wait for what else is around the corner. But
And then they went back to Alex Kurtzman, our director, and Alex said, I understand, I still would like to meet with her. And I said, of course, I'd meet with him in a heartbeat. Yeah. So I did. And we sat down and he asked me, first of all, tell me. That's the first thing he said is tell me. And we were familiar, you know, with each other straight away and we were honest to one another. And he said to me, I understand everything you said and you're right. What you read was some sort of material to get us starting in pre-production.
Yeah.
But it's not going to stay that way. And he took on my notes and he promised me that, you know, what was essential to me was that The Mummy was considered and the psychology of the character was relevant in the story and in the context. And he said, he promised me that it will exist. And then I said, you know, what am I, who am I to say no to a project with a big studio such as Universal to be a part of a film that will essentially give homage to the original one, the 1932 one. That's what Alex told me.
Yeah.
And I said, yes. And then 2 months later, Tom was on board and then Russell Crowe was on board. And I thought, what an amazing thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a long process. It's a movie that I worked on for about a year altogether with reshoots and with the preparation and with filming. And I went through 25 screen tests and all of them were scanned, which is a long process, which is if we went for one look, it would already be in the computer system for visual effects.
Right.
And we went through, and then even when the look were set, the one longest makeup was 6 hours. The shortest one was 4 hours, and it was a tough one. But at the same time, I could have not played the character without having that makeup on. I felt different. People looked at me differently. Yeah. I avoided mirrors towards the end,
right.
And sometimes I would de-rig. And even the de-rig, when we removed the makeup, we had to be done in a bath.
Yeah,
and we had to scrub away all those letters.
Wow.
And that were on my body. It was quite a... Sometimes I would just do my hair and put some makeup on it. Or ask me, what are you going? I said, no, I'm just going home. I'm just sleeping. Yeah. I thought I was going for dinner or see my friends. But how could I have done that? Because I would wrap it quite late and having 2 a.m. call times the next day. It was just so I could look normal.
Yes, yeah, so you and could feel I, like you again yeah. for a moment.
And few times I went home with my makeup on because I couldn't. Sometimes it was useful for me to stay in character and to feel the character and the weight of the character on me and with me. And, you know, the character has a lot of strength, has a lot of power, that woman that I had to find. And the size of it and playing the such a royal sort of energy about her.
Yeah, of course.
And I had to look and dig. I mean, I don't walk around thinking I'm a queen, you know, in my life. So it was a tough one to find.
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, whatever I was terrified about are things that are embraced in the end, even if it was hard. Yeah. The transformation was essential. The size and the strength of the character was essential, and I love that she is, you know, and I think we need those movies nowadays where you see a strong woman that's fighting for what she wants and what she's been promised, and I think it is relevant to the story, and everybody can relate to that. You can maybe disagree about her methods of going about it,
sure.
But you can understand it being deceived and being hurt.
Yeah, and the drive, the drive and the motivation. So having spent a year on it and then having a big gap from it, I guess, because it's a film that's going to have a lot of post and a lot of to bring it all to life. How is it now to be in the reality of it's about to come out? And obviously Kingsman was big, but you had a big role, but it wasn't on your shoulders as such. And Star Trek the same, a big role, but it's an amazing team already. This feels like the first project where, again, obviously, Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe, that's a huge thing. But you're the mummy. You are. It's your movie as such in that way. So, how are you feeling about that and all of the social and commercial commitments ahead and at the moment?
I'm currently swimming in the middle of it because of all the promo I've been doing. It's been quite intense and quite nonstop. I'm embracing it. I've never thought about it, and I think that I'm a day at a time, and I'm not thinking about it really.
Yeah,
I think
great.
I'm still lucky because I think, you know, a lot is on Tom still. And so I feel like I'm sharing that responsibility with him massively, which is helpful.
Yeah, that's great.
But I tend not to think about that too much. You know, it's the minute I step out of set and I still have to do ADR. But aside from that, everything is in between other hands. And all I can think about is work on the project that are to come and strategically, you know, stir my, you know, towards direction and what we want to do next. And I'm lucky to be working on a project called Hotel Artemis.
Yeah.
Soon, right when I come back from promo, it's going to overlap and... And I'm happy to keep working straight after. I don't know what sort of impact this movie is going to have. I just know that it's going to just be out into the world, and people are going to be hopefully able to be either distracted from their everyday lives or have a, you know, be entertained or have a good, you know, experience. Hopefully the people come out of the movie having, you know, laughed or having a little fright, hopefully, and having had a good experience. And I can't wait to see the film myself. I haven't seen it yet.
You haven't seen it? Amazing. Yeah. It feels kind of perfect that you've got the next project is already... is overlapping as such, because the thing that seems to have come up after every amazing project you've worked on that's life-changing is a moment of, is that it now? Am I done? Am I going to get another opportunity? Is it all over? So it'll be nice that this is the biggest moment yet you already know what's next.
Yeah.
There's not that moment after of how has this film changed what is ahead or what is the future. You know, that's still to come and still to be part of it, but you've got a project already that you're invested in and jumping straight into.
I tend to not think about how things will change after they come out.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's wrong to think that way. It doesn't. It shouldn't matter because it's not in my hands.
Yeah.
The only thing that's in my hand is how hard I can work for the next one and the choices I can make in the project that are about to come next. And it's all a gambling, really.
Yeah.
And but I feel in tune when I make decisions a lot of the time. And I feel a bit, you know, I don't want to be too picky. I want to be open as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But I do have a movie culture that was given to me at a young age because my parents watched quite obscure sort of films that I hated watching.
Yeah.
At times, because there was only one TV in the house and my mom was watching this TV channel called Arte.
Yeah.
It was half in French and half in German, and I just had to watch Wings of Desire or Possession or like. And now I adore that I have that movie culture.
Yeah,
it's in me, and even when I started acting, you know, I would have been happy just doing a small independent film because these were the films that I loved the most, and being thrown in Hollywood came out of nowhere, really.
Yeah,
and but I know that the roles that I like to do the most are the roles that I like as an audience the most, and you know, and it could be the entertaining ones, and it could be the more meaningful ones, the one that can inspire people or change people's life if they have that sort of power.
Yeah,
I'm up for anything. I'm just enjoying the ride, and people very often now ask me, so what sort of things do you want to do next? I don't know. I haven't done enough to feel like I need to narrow down and be specific about what I want. When I watch some of the actors that I admire and love the most, and Daniel Day-Lewis is one of my favorite actors.
Yeah.
And you don't like he jumped from one style to another quite easily, and every time you see a character that's so specific and strong, and you barely know anything about him, which allows the audience to just dive in and live with the character for the amount of time that the movie allows that. But I sort of look up to these actors, and I want to be close to that as much as possible, in the sense that I if I can ever be that way, I'd be proud, you know.
That's amazing. And it's kind of, it's always weird the asking of what's ahead or what would you like, because the fact is every role that has shaped your career so far you couldn't have known about a year before. So if you'd been asked a year before Kingsman what you want to be doing, it's like you wouldn't have known the Kingsman was a thing and that it existed, and so on and so forth. So it has to be, well, just having that faith that it will all continue and these projects will come.
People asked me that many times when I started during those 2 years where I didn't work before I booked Kingsman.
Yeah.
People a lot in meetings would ask me, so what do you want to do?
Yeah.
I said, I don't know. It depends on the material. I feel like I'd play a cactus in a movie.
Yeah.
If you ask me to, because if it requires just any sort of imagination and work, and it's just the thrill and the experience was enough for me. And I was happy that way. And I still feel the same, like the same, to be the same person right now, genuinely. So I'm trying just to stay true to what I feel in the moment when I read material.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'll wrap it up there and let you actually hopefully have some relaxing time before it all goes mental again.
What's that?
The Mummy is released on June 3rd and Atomic Blonde is July 28th. So, yeah, you're going to have a hectic month or two,
the
surely,
sirens,
right?
Look,
there's the sirens to close it all off.
Sirens
after we spoke of it. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking. Is it you're on social media and stuff like that, is that something you're into, or are you just there as a
I'm not trying to post anything about my meals I'm trying to not post anything too personal, but I am on Twitter and Instagram.
Perfect.
I don't have Facebook, never had.
That's all good. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time.
You're
it's
welcome.
Been great.
You're very welcome. Thank
Cheers.
You
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
I mean, I told you it was a good episode, didn't I? What an amazing woman. Absolutely inspirational. Wonderfully articulate. Amazing outlook on life. I loved the fact that she quit Madonna's tour. And Madonna was like, oh, have you got a good acting gig? She's like, no, I'm just focusing on that. I'm going to train. I'm going to get good. I'm going to work hard. I love that. Yeah, amazing. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week. I don't know who I'm going to have. At the moment, I've not got it recorded. I won't miss a week, but I'm struggling a bit at the moment because, as I said, I'm filming a lot. I'm away a lot. I keep getting extra days on this film I'm doing. So it's tough, but I'll figure something out. If I've not got a guest, I'll figure something out for you. I've got like 4 guests lined up at the moment. It's just a case of getting the time and getting in the right place and making it all work. Yeah, there will be more. I don't know who's next week, but it's going to be good, I promise you. Anyway, thanks for tuning in, guys. I'm going to stop this rambling. Subscribe and rate and review. Everyone says that. I talked about this before, didn't I? All right, I'll see you later. This has been the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 153 with Sophia Batella. Check out The Mummy. I think it looks amazing. I've not seen it. I was sceptical until I saw the trailers, but I think it looks dope. Even more so, Atomic Blonde. It's now one of the films I'm looking forward to the most. Previous guest, James McAvoy, looks fantastic in it. His accent and his character seems awesome. And Charlize Theron looks like she's smashing it once more. So anyway, films and stuff, they're good. This is a podcast. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.